Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, February 20th. If it works in Colorado, could it work here? We're talking about deed restrictions to make sure local families have an affordable place to live. And a lesson in civics, why a group known for taking stands on environmental issues that affect surfing is getting people involved in the legislative process. And as a deadline for displaced Maui families looms to begin paying rent, we hear more about those asking for a break. And we talk to an expert about how media blackouts from the Trump administration affect journalists and citizens alike. And AI 101, artificial intelligence, is seeping into our everyday life. How to spot deepfakes? Is it real? You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The resort town of Vail, Colorado, has been trying to ensure that local families have a place to live and aren't priced out of the area by investors looking to make the most of their units by renting to tourists. Could deed restrictions work here in the islands? Here to talk about that is HPR's Ashley Mizuo. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, so lawmakers are considering two different measures that, you know, would allow homeowners to sell the county a deed restriction on their property. And then that deed restriction would only allow people who work at least 30 hours or more in that county to live on that property. And the way a deed restriction works is it moves with the property from owner to owner to owner, meaning that in perpetuity, that house would be available only to people who work in that county for 30 hours or more. I spoke with Trey Gordner, a policy researcher at the University of Hawaii's Economic Research Research Organization, or UHERO, and he says it comes from, you know, this idea of restricting the demand versus increasing the supply of housing.
The demand case is kind of picks up from that criticism, and it says, you know, lots of people want to live in Hawaii. Hawaii is paradise. Functionally, there's no way that we could meet local demands. We could never meet outside demand for housing in Hawaii of all kinds. And so what that means is that we need to, in some sense, reserve or produce some housing units that are strictly for locals.
And so that's really kind of like a philosophy or a thought process of the types of ways that Hawaii can address its housing crisis. The criticism of this demand restriction is that, you know, restricting demand can be kind of tricky. Lawmakers can't just, you know, like ban outside investors from buying homes here. That's not legal. They can put restrictions on buildings that maybe have been subsidized through state funds, but they can't really do anything to just like outright ban people from out of state from buying, you know, just like normal homes in a neighborhood. So these types of measures that they're looking at the state legislature this year are voluntary deed restrictions with a work requirement as a way that they are looking to, you know, carve out a market, a housing market only for local residents that work and currently live in that county. You know, deed restriction, as you said earlier, is something that has kind of worked in some other areas in the country where locals are being, you know, priced out because of the amount of tourism in the area. You know, you mentioned Vail, Colorado, a super popular ski destination. They implemented a similar program in 2018, and they were the first in the country to do this. Here's Town of Vail Housing Director Jason Dietz.
It's kind of created a separate market that's below market rate. And it's if we just ran numbers on it, you know, this summer, to take a look and see how it was looking. And it's consistently, on average, you know, 20% below market, which is, you know, the value of the deed restriction. There's no appreciation caps. So when you sell, but that restriction of it only being able to be occupied by members of the local workforce does reduce its market value. Someone from another state that was looking for a ski property to short-term rent, they can't use it for that. And so it has less value. So generally, it has created a market that's below market rate that is restricted.
So he says, you know, the town has been able to transfer about 170 properties into its deed restriction program.
Yeah. And so, you know, we're talking resort destination, right? Vail, Aspen. So does this only apply then to resort areas or what?
No, so actually that's for the whole town. But, you know, in these areas, they're pretty small ski towns. And so even though it applies to the whole town, the town has kind of been overrun by people who want to, you know, buy apartments and only use it for, you know, ski season, like a couple of months in the year. And then because of that, the workers who need to, you know, man the ski lifts, operate the coffee shops, do all the different types of businesses and things that you need to run a, you know, city, can't actually live in the town because there's just no housing available because it's being taken up by so many people, you know, buying these outside investors kind of coming in and buying these vacation homes.
Well, you know, I mean, I just drive around Kaka'ako and see so many dark units in these towers, right? And so, yeah, you don't want these housing units that could be available for local people to be sitting dark, vacant.
Right, right. So this is just one of the different ways that I think lawmakers are considering trying to, you know, make out this particular type of housing market that's only for local people. So the two measures, there are two measures making its way through the legislative process here. You know, one requires property owners in the program to use the funds that they would get from the county from selling that deed restriction to build an additional dwelling unit. Another is more broad, and it's really just up to homeowners how they would spend that money that they get from the county. And so you might be asking, you know, why would anyone want to actually participate in this? And so I spoke with Holomua Collective, a nonprofit dedicated to making Hawaii more affordable. Its director, Josh Wish, says people could even, you know, leverage the money from the deed restriction sale to the county as a down payment that they may otherwise have not been able to secure to buy the property.
They can go to the county, say, we want to buy this home. We need money for the down payment. The county takes a look at it, makes an offer, gives them the money for the down payment. Now you've got someone in the house who wouldn't have otherwise been able to get it. And so that's one clear incentive for someone who's trying to buy a home for the first time. But it could also be for existing homeowners who maybe need to do a cesspool conversion, or they've got some long delayed infrastructure renovations for their house that they want to do, or they've got an in-law who wants to move in and they want to build an ADU. The money is flexible. It could be used for any of those kinds of things.
I like that. It's creative. It's innovative.
Right, right. And you know, this might mean that the resale value of your home may drop because it has this deed restriction on it. But, you know, the money you can receive up front is potentially significant. For example, in Vail, they'll pay up to 20% of the market value of that home for that deed restriction. And so they, in Hawaii, if this got passed, it would likely be negotiated between the county and the owner selling the deed restriction, how much they would get for that. You know, there's also the community component of this, right? You know, many of the advocates I spoke to brought up how a person who lives and works in a place will be more interested in being a contributing member to the neighborhood. I spoke with the president of the Vail Board of Realtors, and he told me this story about a friend of his. He helped buy a deed-restricted home in Vail, and, you know, she wouldn't have been able to afford living in the town otherwise and is now the chair of the Art and Public Spaces Board in Vail. So there are a lot of, like, interesting different ways that this can kind of impact a neighborhood, but you're not necessarily building any more structure, so you don't really have that, you know, kind of, like, NIMBYism either with this type of policy. The proposed bills would have the Hawaii Housing and Finance Development Corporation give counties the funds to purchase the deed restrictions, but it would actually be up to the counties then to administer the program. So here's Kauai Housing Director Adam Reversi, who says that they've actually been looking into a program like this before this got proposed at a state level, and it could be one of the missing pieces for Kauai to address affordable housing.
We often talk about increasing the housing supply in Hawaii generally and on Kauai to address affordable housing. But simply increasing supply without attention to the types of homes being built and who the supply is for is not necessarily by itself going to solve our affordability crisis.
And the one issue that you measures, these measures will give counties the funds to buy the deed restrictions, it would then be up to the counties to cover, you know, all the administrative work and do enforcement. And that's one of the things that when I spoke to the city and county of Honolulu, they're really sensitive to. Jason in Vail says it really only took about one person to set the program up there, and his whole office is only three people. They have this annual compliance period where people are required to submit their taxes and W-2 forms to confirm that they work in the county. But I'm going to caveat all of this with that the town of Vail is only about 7,000 people, whereas even Kauai, the smallest county, is almost 75,000 people. But it's much easier to administer a program like this versus building something brand new and managing all the different types of income restrictions. And
yeah, but at least you've got people looking at trying something different, right? I mean, we can't be doing the same
thing. Yeah, this is definitely a new approach hasn't been introduced at the state level before. So.
Okay, well, we'll see how successful it is and if we can clear all the hurdles.
Great, thank you.
But thanks for tracking this.
Yeah.
That was HFAIR's government reporter, Ashley Mizuo, who is looking at a bill to try and increase the stock of affordable housing for working families here in Hawaii. Check out her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Mokuo ke ave. Join Hawaii Public Radio at Kahilu Theater on Friday, March 21st for a live taping of The Conversation and Kanikabila Sunday. We talk story with author and longtime Parker Ranch veterinarian Billy Bergen, UH biology professor Patrick Hart of Manu Minute, and Hilo singer-songwriter Kainani Kahaunaele. For more information, visit hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Big Island Coffee Roasters and Merriman's Restaurants.
Support for HPR comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits offering workforce housing solutions for young kama'aina training to become farmers, such as the Waianae Community Redevelopment Corporation. NereidHawaii.com.
We get our communities to be stoked on civics? Well, that's a question the nonprofit Surf Rider Foundation is trying to answer here in Hawaii. They're holding a workshop later today in Kaka'ako to demystify the legislative process. The Conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with Hana Lilly, Surf Rider's regional manager for the Hawaiian Islands, about civic engagement.
Why is it important to learn about civics? I mean, especially right now when a lot of people might be stressed out by the idea of the government and all they want to do is like not think about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're at a tipping point right now. It's super overwhelming. Every day you turn on the news and it just seems like it's getting worse. And I mean, I think that, you know, we're all seeing on a federal level that things that seem to compromise the integrity of our democratic system. And I understand the pull to want to give up and kind of succumb to the overwhelm, but this is really the time to lean in. You know, we're at that tipping point and we can still make a change at a grassroots level, at a local level, at a state level, and we need to remain involved in that decision-making process, especially now.
What are some of the things you're looking at on the local level that you feel like are especially important for people to be aware and civically engaged?
So I think it's important to point out that civics does not just refer to legislature and the decision-making process. There's a variety of ways that you can give back to your community and engage in civics. And that could be picking up trash at the beach. That could be making a choice not to use a single-use plastic bottle. That could be going to a community meeting like we're holding. That could be going to the Capitol. But there's a whole variety of ways that you can make a difference in the community.
How did the Stoked on Civics event come about?
So, yeah, legislative session can be a very intimidating thing for most people. And one of the goals of Surf Rider Foundation Stoked on Civics is to make that process more approachable. I mean, we have around 3,000 bills that go through Hawaii State Legislature every year. And our focus are on bills, of course, that relate to Surf Rider Foundation. But we're really trying to make this process a little bit more manageable for everybody to be a part of.
So just the sheer number of bills is an issue. But what are some of the other things that tend to trip people up about the legislative session?
I mean, it can be intimidating for one. You know, there's different ways to engage in legislative session, whether that be writing testimony through the Capitol website, which also can be a little bit tricky. You know, it can be tricky staying up to date on when your bill is going to a committee hearing. It's you generally have a couple of days to get it together. and then you have to submit it 24 hours before. So there's all of these protocols that make it a little bit complex, but also there's the intimidating factor of going and speaking with your representatives and going and giving that oral testimony. And, you know, if you're wanting to get involved in the decision-making process, we want to be able to provide you with the resources to make your voice as impactful as it can be. We're going to walk you through how to submit testimony, how to navigate that website. We're also going to have Senator Chris Lee there to kind of talk you through on how to make the most impact when you are speaking with your representatives and going to these committee hearings. I mean, I think it's also really important to know the ins and outs of these bills. So that's why we'll have guest speakers to give more in-depth explanation of what the bill is, why it matters to you, and what those talking points can be. It's going to be at 5:30 p.m. to 8 p.m. at Box Jelly in Kaka'ako.
Is there anything people should be keeping an eye out for at this particular point in the legislative session?
Yeah, I think that we're at that tricky point where there's a lot of bills that in order to make it through crossover have to be heard in their final committee. So this is kind of a time to be writing those committees and asking them to schedule it for a hearing in order for that bill to survive and make it through crossover. For each hearing, or for each committee hearing of a bill, there's multiple ways for a community member to get involved to either support or oppose that bill. You could go on the website, the Capitol website, and then you have to first create a login, which we will go through at our event. But you can submit written testimony, you can submit oral testimony via video conference or going down to the Capitol. And then this is all, generally you want to get that done within 24 hours of the hearing for it to be considered.
At the end of the day, why is it important for you guys, an environmental nonprofit, to want to encourage civic awareness and civic engagement?
Surfrider Foundation is a volunteer-led organization. So we have civics in the very core of our mission, and it's all run by people that have this calling for civic engagement. And whether that be running our programs for beach cleanups and ocean-friendly gardens and promoting more sustainable restaurants, and whether that be a volunteer that wants to get more involved in policy and in advocacy, there's a whole spectrum of places for volunteers to plug in. And we want to provide the opportunity for people to join in on that and plug in where they fit best.
That was Hannah Lilly with the Surfrider Foundation talking to HR's Maddie Bender. We'll have a link to the Stoked on Civics events on our website after the show. Families displaced by the Maui wildfires and getting help from FEMA face a March 1st deadline to start paying rent. Today, HBR's Catherine Kluwer-Pachtel highlights an extreme hardship case, just one of many appeals pending before the federal agency for a break on the deadline. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning. So this week I talked with fire survivor Beatrice Ho'opai, and she is one of many, as you mentioned, who is still waiting to hear back from FEMA on the appeal case. So as you said, starting on March 1st, there's a big change for fire survivors coming up. Up until this point, they have been, those in the FEMA direct housing program have been housed free of cost for them. That's changing on March 1st. And so Beatrice Ho'opai and her family have been living in a three-bedroom house in Kahoma Village under FEMA's housing program. They're being told that they need to pay $3,108 in rent starting on March 1st. And that's based on fair market rent set by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. But FEMA says they are adjusting some based on household income. And so she is one of the households that have filed an appeal case to try and get that lowered. Her husband died of cancer in December. He was the only income earner in their family. And she just found out that her son was just diagnosed with the same type of cancer as her husband passed away from. She's also, along with caring for her very sick son, raising her two toddler grandchildren. So she's in a really, really tough spot. They have no income, and they're coming up on this $3,000+ rent in a week. Beatrice Ho'opai shared one example of the frustrations and heartbreak of this process ongoing with FEMA that has been leading up, that was leading up to her husband's death.
The heartbreaking part of this whole FEMA stuff is that I think it's bullshit, because my husband was scheduled for two surgery appointments, but if I didn't meet with FEMA, we would be put off. We wouldn't be having their help or resources. So I had to cancel my husband's surgery in Oahu. I had to cancel his surgery here on Maui and the surgeries that he needed in order to fight the cancer. And that was put off. And then from that, it spread to his bones and then finally his liver. And then now I am left without my provider, my best friend, my husband. And it was my female worker who said that's part of their rules. They got to meet us at the house unless it's an emergency. I said, my husband get appointments. I cannot meet with you guys. Please let me change our meeting date. And he says, no, we cannot. I need to meet you at this time. So my husband just was pushed on the side, I guess.
Oh, that's heartbreaking.
It is. And it's just one example of the many really frustrations that fire survivors have been dealing with in the FEMA process along the way. You know, they've shared with me, multiple people have shared that, you know, they get passed from one caseworker to another. They just get to know someone and then, you know, they get a new caseworker and have to retell their entire story over again. Paperwork is getting lost. Along with the stress of filing an appeal on this rent deadline coming up and not knowing whether her family will have a home next month, Beatrice Ho'opai has also been dealing with anxiety of living right across the road from the burn zone in Lahaina. And many survivors are struggling with this on a daily basis. You know, she said she has panics and packs their truck whenever she sees smoke in their neighborhood. And it's a struggle for her to drive through Lahaina every day, bringing, you know, flashbacks of her family's really narrow escape from the fire. And she believes her family is actually suffering from health issues because of the proximity to that ash and debris cleanup.
We're trying to get our life together, and now it's like falling to pieces because of our current situation and what we're facing. But regardless, if I lost my husband, I still feel pressured by FEMA because, I mean, like, I don't know where I'm taking my family. And it's already scary just being here facing this fire zone every freaking day, smelling the... We all over here getting sick just because they put us right into the middle of the fire zone. And they're still cleaning up across the street. And now that with the ACs being down, we have to leave the windows open so we smell all of that. And they said that the air is clean. I was like, you guys full of shit. And they said the water is clean, but every other day you got to scrub the toilet because there's this black stuff that is constantly there. I took photos too.
Yeah, being there sounds like it's just really wearing them down as well.
It is, and, you know, she's begged FEMA to move them to a different location outside of Lahaina, and, you know, she hasn't gotten a response on that request. But Rebecca Uccellini-Kubi is Program Director of Makai Foundation. It's a grassroots nonprofit that's helping fire survivors navigate some of these challenges, especially those who fall into these categories that are kind of falling through the cracks of the system or maybe don't qualify for FEMA. She said she's worked with burn victims who had to be transferred to the mainland, and then when they came back, they missed all of these FEMA deadlines. She's been assisting Ho'opai through the appeals process. And Uccellini-Kubi says she's worked on over 100 of these appeal cases recently with FEMA, and about a quarter of those are still waiting to hear back. This is just the cases that she's been helping with. She says there's a lot of confusion surrounding this whole process. She says it's not clear what the time frame is that people have to move out if they're not able to pay on March 1st. You know, some people have been told they have 14 days if they can't make that payment. And she says it's not even clear where they have to send their payments and whether they have to be received by March 1st or whether they have to be postmarked by that date. So there's just a lot of, you know, still misinformation surrounding this deadline coming up. Another challenge she identified was FEMA, you know, caseworkers, as I said earlier, are constantly changing. And so people are just having to go through this over and over again. This morning, Uchalini Kubi shared an update on the appeals from the cases that she's been helping with.
Luckily, this week actually has been the week most of my cases have heard back between last week and this week. I want to say maybe a quarter are still waiting to hear back. Some of those are newer cases. So, you know, some I've been working with for a little while and some just came to me in the last 2 weeks as these deadlines were getting closer. I would say, you know, a lot of my cases did get a good letter back saying you only have to pay $50 a month, which is great. Some of my like larger families, and especially some of my families who, some that have medical challenges and the medical bills are quite high, those ones got, you know, a slight deduction, a few hundred dollars off the rent, up to $1,000 off the rent. And, you know, we're having to do a second or third appeal and get more information. And, you know, we just don't really know if any of those pieces will actually be taken into account, like kind of the full story of their income reality. Or if they're just basing it off of the income that what it looks like on paper. So, you know, those who have very high medical bills and have to pay things out of pocket, that's really, so far, it doesn't look like that's been taken into consideration.
Yeah, so this is really a really complicated process.
It is. And, you know, HOPI, along with others, are still waiting to find out, you know, how much rent they'll have to pay. Uchalini Kubi says the Mackay Foundation has provided almost $200,000 in emergency housing assistance over the past 7 months. And she says they can assist Ho'opai's family in the short term with rent, depending on the outcome of their appeal. So, you know, a lot of tension here coming up. And I just want to mahalo fire survivors for sharing these stories. You know, I'm really grateful for them sharing their experiences, even the frustrations. You know, we're here for those stories, and we want to make sure they're not forgotten. So,
yeah,
mahalo to them.
And kudos to all the advocates that are helping to navigate this process. But thank you so much,
Absolutely.
Catherine.
Absolutely. Thank you.
We've been hearing from HPR's Maui Nui reporter, Catherine Kluwe-Pachtel. You can read her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Think about the last time you had to have a hard conversation with someone. Did you put it off?
You do have to sort of think about, why are we avoiding these topics? And are those reasons good? Are they biased? Are they preventing us from having a deeper relationship?
Finding a way through tough discussions. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art, a collaborating site of the Hawaii Triennial 25 Aloha No, now on view through May 4th, honolulumuseum.org.
The Trump administration continues to put restrictions on how federal agencies can communicate with the outside world. Employees with the Department of Health and Human Services, as well as one of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, have been told to suspend much of their communication with scientific partners, as well as the media. What do these blackouts mean for journalists and listeners? Fernanda Camarena is a faculty member at the Poitner Institute who's been looking at how media gag orders affect the work of journalism and the information that the public gets. She's a co-author of a report titled Shut Out: Strategies for Good Journalism When Sources Dismiss the Press. The Conversation's D.W. Gibson spoke with her about the consequences of these media blackouts.
The truth is, it has always been hard to get information from those in power. That's why we have investigative reporting. News organizations file FOIAs, Freedom of Information Acts. They also take agencies to court and go into records. And so whether it's a government department or the White House, there has always been some level of reluctancy from newsmakers to be held accountable. Now, some officials within these agencies in our current government speaking anonymously out of fear of retaliation, have told several media organizations that Trump's directive goes far beyond past restrictions. They describe it as a sort of direct effort to silence health experts rather than just a messaging purpose. So the full impact of these orders remains to be seen, but I do think that there's going to be a big ripple effect in the ways that we do our journalism and how we held people in power accountable.
Well, at the Poynter Institute, I know you and your colleagues have been collecting examples and contemplating strategies to stem the erosion of access that you're talking about that undermines the value of independent reporting and that in turn helps citizens participate robustly in their civic life. Give us some sense of examples that have caught your attention.
These challenges aren't new, but they are getting worse. Newsrooms are relying on more anonymous sources. And other ways journalists are adapting to this trend, frankly, is partnering with legal teams, leaning into data journalism, for example, or building networks of whistleblowers to counteract when lawmakers deny them access. When officials shut out the press, they are really shutting out the public. And when journalists make it clear why they're being blocked, it shifts the conversation from a media issue to a democracy issue.
I think that's what matters to our listeners, frankly. You know, agencies going dark affects the information that each voter, each taxpayer gets. So talk a little bit more about how this relates to the idea that journalists should let go of the fear that they don't want to become this story, as you wrote.
We're living in a moment that the whole no comment, as we see in a lot of news reports, we reached out to this person and received no comment, and you continue with your narrative or with your story. We need to change that. That is a disservice to the audience. We need to add context onto why is it that they're not speaking. And not only the why, but the how and what is the ripple effect in people's lives without that information. I think if we don't have that context around the lack of availability or the lack of access or the no comment, we're not really telling the full story. And sometimes us as journalists, we always say, you know, we don't want to be part of the story, but it is not about us. It is about the audience and it is about the information that is being denied. And if we focus on that, it's about the people's right to be well informed.
Yeah, such a great point. And you have a great example in the report about the University of Florida, the school newspaper there, dealing with a no comment situation. Could you tell us a little bit about that? Because I think it's really illustrative.
So the editor of this newspaper at the University of Florida, he and his team were facing this reluctance of the incoming president not being available to just sit down with the students' newspaper. They once, twice, three times tried to reach out to the president and, you know, the president wasn't available for any type of interview or scrutiny. And so the students saw an opportunity to make public this issue that they were facing. They released an editorial really showcasing their ongoing efforts to reach SASE. And I love not only the fact that they released a specific editorial to inform the public of what was going on and to inform the students, but the way that the language and their style was very much in tone of them as a university. And they mentioned something like, paging Ben Sasse, are you there? They even posted flyers throughout the campus to see if he responded. So, you know, I think there's a lot of things that we can learn from the student community because it shows that you're working for the audience, you're working for the people, And the people need to know all of your efforts. And the way to do so is to really meet them where they are, is to show them in the language that you share with your audience, the style, and be candid about your efforts.
That phrase, no comment, I think falls so flat for so many readers. It's such a rote statement at this point. It just sort of listeners brush right past it, I think. And this example at the University of Florida, you're speaking to the sort of conversational tone they took in the editorial, posting bills and notices around campus that people can physically see, and sticking to very specific information. We called this amount of times. I think all of this is engagement in trying to get people that are a part of that community to care about the lack of information.
Correct. If you're not transparent with your audience about moments that you are blocked or issues that you encounter throughout your reporting, they don't see themselves or they don't see the full picture reflected in your story, it diminishes your credibility. You start losing audience, you start losing the trust in your community. And that is really, really, really hard to come back. It's the, I would say, the most detrimental thing that a journalist can face.
You know, one thing you wrote about is the importance of journalists partnering rather than competing to cover more ground. Can you talk more about what that looks like in practical terms?
A lot of the times we think of our competitors as people or agencies that are trying to beat us or are competing for something. And I think what's beautiful with journalism in times of struggle and in times of transformation is that we all serve the same goal. We all function under the same principles. And based on those guiding journalistic principles, we have a beautiful common ground to make sure that our common goal is fulfilled. It doesn't matter if it's by one journalist, by two journalists, or by five journalists working together. And so part of the reason why collaborating is very important is because you take what each journalist or each news org has to offer, and you build a great, effective, strong mosaic of the best way to move forward. So collaborating rather than not competing can give you a way of saying, well, I can't afford legal fees, and therefore I'm going to collaborate with a news organization that does have that resource.
The report says that political polarization, repeated vitriol from those who would demonize the media, and a breakdown of relationships between journalists and the people they cover have made the problem more severe. Those sound like big issues. How does such a ship get righted? Or is that a sort of old-fashioned way of thinking about things? Is there a new way we should be thinking about the media landscape we find ourselves in?
We have to meet our audience where they're at. If you don't have an audience that is proactively going into your website and really searching for those answers and basically taking that initiative, it is our responsibility, the same effort we put in reporting, being accurate, transparent, and fair, it is as important to also meet them and to also seek their opinion and show them what we have without necessarily expecting them to come to us. So we're seeing a lot of efforts on how to partner up with media influencers or how to be a little bit more effective on social media. We've seen some mainstream news organizations decide to really go into the digital space, into the social space, and say, you know, we don't really have a lot of people tuning in 6 to 7 for their prime time newscast. And so if we really want to serve our audience, we need to meet them where they are. I just also want to mention something on news consumption. When reporters can't talk to government sources daily, it limits the range of viewpoints the public gets. Right? So instead of hearing from a variety of perspectives, we often only hear through the government side, through official sites, which is the press releases or just official information out there. And information doesn't equal truth. The fact that reporters are only getting press releases doesn't mean that that's truth. That's information. And it's our job to verify, and it's our job to provide context. With fewer traditional outlets having access to government officials, people are turning into social media for breaking news. And so social media, as we know, can be a double-edged sword. Information often gets distorted and gets distorted faster. So it can also create public confusion. This uncertainty can really spread confusion and make people even more skeptical about the media and the government.
The point you make reminds me of a guest we had on the show recently, a nonprofit leader, who was speaking to the fact that we value information, we value facts, the information that leads to facts. But we also can't forget that people have feelings, that people are having emotional reactions to the world they find themselves in right now. And I think that that's sort of the balancing act right now, meeting people where they're at, meeting readers and listeners where they're at, and at the same time, striving to make sure you're also not only speaking to that emotion, but sticking to facts. That's the balance, right?
Correct. And we have to also make sure that we are, in a way, rebranding our facts. And I know that sounds a little odd, but the same way that we personalize our stories and have that deep connection that you mentioned, a connection that resonates with people's day-to-day lives, and people see themselves reflected on the information that we provide because we personalize that information with things that they can touch, they can hear, they can feel. With the same way, we need to look at facts that way. I know there's this idea that, you know, when presenting facts or data or things that we know and we've researched and we verified, just to put it out there and say, well, that's a false statement, and just leave it that like that. I know it's not the best way for people to relate and to understand and to really see how it affects their lives. I've seen time and time again in social media, a single post from a specific news org just saying, well, that was a false comment. And just to leave it like that, I think we can do a better job. I think there's instances that, you know, we need to call out what's false. But I also think that there's a great opportunity to call out truths.
We can do better. That was Fernanda Camarena of the Poynter Institute talking with HPR's D.W. Gibson. They were discussing the Trump administration's restrictions on media access to public officials and how it affects listeners like you. Have you seen the viral video of humpback whales swimming in the Alawai Canal? Or what about snow on top of Diamond Head? Well, you'd be among millions of viewers on social media who have. Gabriel Yanagihara teaches computer science at Iolani School and is behind the local viral videos. The Conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with Yanagihara about the unconventional class assignment that led to the videos and how we can all be more informed about generative AI.
So me, alongside a couple other teachers at Iolani School, we're always looking at places where the students can kind of explore with new technologies, try new things in kind of like a, not like a walled garden, but like a safe place. So this summer, we did an AI boot camp. I really wanted to see what these generative AI tools were going to do to the educational world. So it was 6 hours a day for 2 weeks, just pummeling them through every example project we could. And I'm running it again this summer, too. The idea is that the students can get early access to the tools, try them out, and then see what crazy projects we could come up with. So one of the projects that spurred from that was the idea that an awareness of the necessity for AI literacy within our keiki and our kupuna, right? Like right now with generative AI, I can get a picture off Facebook, bring it to life with AI video, have it sound like them with an audio clip, and have them FaceTime you asking your, you know, have a picture of your grandkid call the grandparents and say, hey, mom, I need college tuition. Can you wire this money to me kind of thing, right? And that's starting to happen with some of these scary examples of generative AI tools. So we're like, okay, how do these students make it so that everyone learns what AI can do without scaring them? Idea came up with is like, let's come up with a bunch of viral, silly ideas that will get shared and people will be like, oh, that's not real, that's AI, just to plant that seed and spread awareness of what the capabilities are within our local communities. So very localized, viral video ideas, generated ideas by students and, you know, anyone I come across, and then we just post it up and see what happens.
Give a couple examples of what has come from that.
So one of the first examples from that really kicked off was the idea of like, we're doing all this work to clean the Alawai Canal. What would it look like if it was actually so clean and a little bit deeper, right? And you could put a humpback whale in the Alawai Canal. So we went to the AI tools. We used Google's VO2 new AI model, and we were able to put humpback whales in the Alawai Canal. And these photorealistic videos being posted and circulated online for millions of views of people who, even though it's labeled AI, aren't reading the caption and seeing that and thinking, oh my God, the Alawai is clean now. They're humpback whales, right? That's obviously not the case yet, but that there's two parts, right? One, it illustrates the need for being aware of what these tools can do. And two, that paints a pretty cool future that we can visualize that could spur public action towards actually cleaning the Alawai.
It's funny. I mean, you have a smile on your face as you're telling me this. You're clearly optimistic, but is there a part of you that's like terrified?
So when I first started playing with these tools, the ChatGPT 3.5 and everything, it really illustrated that how much work, more work I was able to get done in the same amount of time, put me in a situation where like me with my consulting business, even me as a teacher, like I can clearly see I would never hire someone who wasn't fluent in these tools. Like it's not that AI is going to take your job. My students who are trained in AI will, because they can do much more output than anyone else can do. And if they can use it safely and ethically and efficiently, that's going to be the workforce of the future. Like, so it's scary in that regard if you're not trained, but if you are trained in these AI literacy and AI tools, it's going to be kind of like the calculator or the email, right? Like when it first came out, it's this terrifying, scary thing. But like now it's kind of boring. In all the AI literacy work that I do, if I can make AI boring, that means I've done my job.
What are some of the basics to AI literacy? If we use this example of humpback whales swimming in the Alawai, how can people from seeing that post on social media know that it's AI generated?
So putting that image out there, right, there are a couple errors anytime you generate AI visuals, right? It's not going to be super perfect yet. But things they noticed, right? A couple of checklists, like did it come from a credible source? I'm just a random Instagram account, right? Was it vetted? Do you see it by media channels? Is HPR publishing about it, right? So checking your sources for it. And two, just having a critical sense of, is this practical? Is this realistic? Is this something that could actually happen? Even more so, diving deep, looking carefully at the video and seeing that there's two-way traffic on the Alawai Canal. And a bunch of people caught that. And that was like one of the key defining factors for a lot of people is like, oh, I caught that was AI because I know there's no two-way traffic on Alawai, right?
There also is a tag that users can mark their own content as AI generated, which could be the first thing that you look for. Although surely not every AI generated video is going to appear as such.
Yeah, that's going to be one. All these social media companies are trying to find that way of communicating that it's AI or not. You can't detect if it's AI, even with like essays and stuff. Any of those tools that are claiming, oh, we can tell if your students wrote with ChatGPT or not, are essentially just using statistics, and it's not a good fit, right?
One more thing I was thinking about with the viral videos on social media, was there anything that experiment showed you about Hawaii's influencer social media ecosystem?
One of the things that I've seen, if all the people in the social media sphere I've talked to, their hearts are in good places, right? They just want to get information out as quick as possible. So the best that I can do as an individual is to help educate as much as possible, right? Educate them on AI literacy. So when they are getting information and they can be as informed as possible as anyone else, right? Because these people with tons of followers are just like you and me. They're just average citizens who happen to get like these followings on social media platforms. So maybe them more than anyone should get the AI literacy training early, so that they can be the frontline guards for it. Because we're not going to be in the business of telling them what they can and can't post. We can't really do that. But we can at least equip them with the tools and frameworks so that they can self-police or self-direct what kind of brand they want to build.
Who offers this training? Is it just you?
My mission is to make like 1,000 of me. Like if each teacher I talk to can then go and talk to 2 or 3 students or like influence like one classroom of people, we could solve this in like no time, right? Granted, that's going to take a lot of educational effort. And using those same social media hubs, like if I could get one video of me explaining this stuff to be as viral as something like the humpback whale or putting snow on Diamond Head, like if I could get it that popular, we could solve this problem overnight. We could get people aware of what it's capable of so that they don't fall for the scams that might be coming in the coming years where someone's like doing a deep fake of their parents, that kind of stuff, right?
What else would you say in kind of that elevator pitch if you had a short form video like that go viral the same way Snow on Diamond Head is?
I would say like the main thing with this and any other emerging technology is just to stay curious, right? If you're curious, you want to know answers. If you want to know answers, you're going to dig into how the technology works. If you understand how it works, it's not that scary, right? It's just statistics being applied to either language for the ChatGPT and Claude models or Gemini models to like video, right? So as long as you're curious and you take the extra time it takes to make yourself educated on what they can do, you don't have to be an expert in using them. But as long as you're aware of what the capabilities are, you're not going to fall for it, or you're at least going to second check if someone sends you like a deep fake or something like that, right?
Mm-hmm. So do you feel like by actually playing around with these models and experimenting, people can get a better sense of what they look like out in the wild, be able to spot and debunk?
Yeah, that's one of the biggest things. Like, it sounds like magic. It looks like this crazy, scary thing. But once you have your hands on it and you ask ChatGPT to generate you 1,000 posts on Instagram, or you use Google's video model to create like a sea turtle skydiving or something like that, once you're aware of what they can do, it becomes a lot less scary. And then it makes it so it, you take a deep breath and you're like, oh, okay, if someone like me can do this, then at least I'm aware that anyone can do this. And I'll look at things with a second glance now going forward.
And are you worried at all that by telling people how to do this, they're going to try it on their own and we'll find even more of this AI-generated content that will be kind of duping people across the internet?
We're definitely going to be entering a phase of where, you know, right now it's all memes, right? Or deep-fried memes where people are rehashing and re-editing and re-scripting content. If I had to take a guess, and this is very much a guess, I wouldn't invest on this idea, is the idea that we're going to enter an era where anyone can generate anything for free. We're going to have tons of content, misleading, funny, cute cats doing kung fu, all kinds of stuff coming out. And then it'll become less novel, and then it'll tone down to just what we're capable of. So the cat's out of the bag, right? Anyone can generate anything for free at any time using a $400 home computer. So the work that has to be done now is, how do we react as a society? How do we educate everyone? And then how do we make it so the tools are being used by people whose voices we want to amplify and be seen more than the people who are early adopters who are going to use it for their own benefit or play around and stuff like that, right? So you can easily drown out the negative with good work is kind of my overall philosophy with anything technology. And I'm hoping that's the case that we do. Because I want to see a ton of videos of like dolphins and turtles in the Alawai and a lot less videos of like fake, you know, cats doing kung fu, like less of the silly stuff and more things that spark imagination and creativity.
That was Iolani educator Gabriel Yanagihara talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. We will have links to his viral fake videos of whales swimming in the Alawai Canal on our website after the show. Well, that's it for us today. Up tomorrow, we're taking the conversation on the road. We'll be broadcasting live from on the edge of Waikiki as we ponder rising sea levels and climate change. Got feedback for us? Call our talkback line 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find the conversation on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.